Side 6, Eon by Greg Bayer, continuing on page 215. He had programmed communications processors to track on multiple bands and retrieve all messages, storing concurrent messages for separate playback. He had a ringside seat. There was even some video coming down the borehole. He witnessed the crown fire sweeping the earth before the signal gave out. It was purely by accident that he looked over his shoulder and spotted the moving glimmer of white. It swung smoothly over his head and to the opposite side. Whatever it was, it seemed to be spiraling around the plasma tube, staying within the plasma layer. Its wake was a visible shadow within the general glow. There were no other aircraft within the stone, none that he had heard of, at any rate. He doubted the Russians had anything sophisticated enough to follow such a difficult course. What was it, then? A boojum. In the middle of all the excitement, he had seen his first boojum. That's always the way, isn't it? He switched on the aircraft's tracking systems. For a moment, he had a clear blip on the screens, and even a computer-enhanced magnification of the craft's general outline. It was sleek and resembled a blunted arrowhead. He recorded about 5 seconds of information on it before the trackers suddenly wheeped and lost the target. Patricia felt icy cold inside. She stared through the transparency in the side of Olmi's craft, watching the even tan and pale gray landscape passing below. Two personalities conflicted within her. One, by far the stronger, forbade any motion or outward reaction. The second was a normal, fascinated, even slightly amused Patricia. If she spoke, she knew the second Patricia, the distant, uninvolved one, would try to be funny and make light of what was happening. But the first had grown to a position of control, and she did not speak. She did not even move her head. She simply stared at the walls of the corridor, turning and passing behind them. "Are you hungry or thirsty?" Olmi asked. She did not answer. "Are you tired? Do you need to sleep?" "Nothing." "We'll be some time. Several days. The Axis city is 1,000,000 kilometers along the way. The corridor, now. Please let us know if you're in need." He glanced back at the France, but received only an outward turning of one eye, indicating nothing to suggest. Patricia could feel it all coming apart, all the tight-wound ambition and hope. Could not hold back this inevitable shattering. Her shoulders began to shake. She looked around at Olmi and quickly turned away. Her eyes seemed to float. Tears gathered and broke away when she shook her head, drifting around her. She slowly raised her hands and held them before her face. The teardrops touched and spread on her fingers and palms. "All going now. All the glue going." Her chest heaved. "Please," she whispered. "They're dead. Really gone. You didn't save them. Please." "Miss Vasquez." Olmi reached across to touch her, then drew his hand back as she flinched away.
"Ah, Jesus y Maria."
Her body jerked and her legs shook with the force of her sobs. Each tore something out of her chest and pierced the dark behind her eyelids with jagged red. She clutched her shoulders with her hands and rocked back and forth in the couch, back arched, teeth clenched and lips drawn back. Her spine reversed of its own will, and she curled her chest and knees together. "Is this a fit? This is grief. This is loss. This is awareness. This is not fooling yourself." Olmi did not try to restrain her. He watched the woman weeping for a world lost to his kind, for 13 centuries. Ancient woman, ancient agony. Patricia Luisa Vasquez grieved for dead billions and ways of living unknown to him. "She is an open wound," the France said, moving forward to crouch by Olmi's shoulder. "I wish to help, but I can't."
"Nobody can help," Olmi said. Even across 1,300 years, the death bent and hobbled his people with scar tissue. That became clear to him, looking at her, gauging her differences. The nexus had been forged in the death. The Naderites had come to power as a result. And how many of their prejudices, how much of their willful blindness, was a drawn-out echo of Patricia's pain. If help is impossible for her, then it hurts me to think, the Frant said.
Chapter 30. Gerhardt carried the roll of maps from his makeshift command headquarters. They controlled the southern end of the first chamber, including the science team compounds, and the elevators to the South Polar borehole. They're still fighting us in the second chamber, but it looks like a standoff. Berenson sent half his troops from the fourth chamber as soon as the alert was sounded. They crossed the bridge under heavy fire. The Russians didn't try anything in the third chamber, and they're scattered in the fourth, not very effective. Gerhardt smoothed the map down with a sweep of one hand. We don't have the strength to wipe them out, but they don't have the strength to take more ground than they already have. And so far, they haven't responded to our overtures. We still have people in the staging areas, Lanier asked. Yes, and they can hold out there for months. We hadn't shipped down the last load of food and supplies. Fourth chamber is self-sufficient, and Berenson's troops are definitely in control there, so it looks like the only problem will be the first and second chambers. Our soldiers have supplies for about 2 weeks. Unless we drop supplies to them from the Axis, we're studying that proposal now. They'll run out. How are we handling the heavy lifters outside? Still haven't let them in. There's one we suspect is carrying heavy equipment to be dropped into the second chamber from the Axis. We don't want them breaking through the barricade. They don't sound happy, but they can cool their heels for a few days without any problems. They've offered to surrender? Gerhardt shook his head. No. Pletnyov broadcast his little speech, but he's not going to turn his ships over yet. He's offered to try to negotiate an end to hostilities. The heavy lifter crews want to join their comrades. They know they can't go home, and I suspect they know their troops inside are under strength because of the carnage in the borehole. Such a goddamn desperate maneuver. It didn't work anywhere, Gerhardt said grimly, but it's put us in an uncomfortable position. The stone is a capped bottle as far as we're concerned. Not that we particularly want to leave. I could go anywhere if we did. I'm worried about Spetsnaz myself. They could have assassins and sappers spread throughout the second chamber by now, and they'll find their way to us in a few days. We don't have the troop strength to keep them out of the third chamber or the fourth. They're nasty individuals, Gary, dedicated and well-trained. The longer we wait, the more they'll drain us. So we're at an impasse in the second chamber, Lanier asked, his eyes darting nervously to the maps. Everywhere. Nobody's going to move. The only thing progressing will be casualty counts. Do you think they know that? I mean, will they acknowledge it to themselves? Having come all this way, with all the training that would require, I think we can safely say their COs aren't fools. What about the grunts? Like us, I doubt they have any grunts. How long before they start listening to reason? Hell, Gary, they may be listening now. They're just not showing any sign. We stick our heads up, they start shooting, and vice versa. The sergeant stood before his superiors with a troubled expression. His face was covered with scratches from crawling through undergrowth in the patches of forest. He saluted and bowed in Mirsky's direction. Colonel, they have found our transponders in the boreholes. We cannot communicate with any other chambers. Now I ask you, Mirsky said, is that a sign they want to lay down their arms and welcome the wolves into the sheep pen? Garabedian took his binoculars and surveyed the forests and fields between them and the bridge, a kilometer away. He then looked at the shell-pocked, laser-scored bridge, marred but still very much functional, and returned the glasses. Pavel, Garabedian said, we should cut that bridge, don't you think? Mirsky looked at his deputy commander disapprovingly. And what other way do we have to cross? We can walk 50 kilometers or more to the next bridge, or we can swim. Then they cannot cross, and they cannot get any more reinforcements from this chamber. No, but they can be reinforced from the first chamber. We have no idea how many there are in there. Trapped like pigs. We keep this bridge intact, Mirsky said. Besides, we can ill afford to lose more men on a desperation move, or to lose them from snipers while we swim. It was an idea, Garabedian said. I am not short on ideas, Viktor. I am short of laser cannon and artillery. We can assume Gigli, with all our artillery and supplies, did not make it through,
and will not now, since they have obviously reinforced the boreholes enough to find our transponders. We can assume our operative has been captured, and the Russian science team is ineffective, either by choice or because they are in stockade. And we can also assume that our heavy lifter pilots and crew do not relish staying outside for weeks while we get ourselves killed in here.
What are you saying, Pavel? Be blunt, Garabedian smiled. With his undershot jaw, he had always reminded Mirsky of a sturgeon. We are not getting the support we need. Do you believe the war has been fought on Earth and lost?
Mirsky shook his head.
I believe we have taken out their orbital capability. That would make quite a show from up here. Pavel, they surely can tell the difference between an orbital showdown and Holocaust.
Mirsky clamped his jaw and shook his head stubbornly.
We are here to fight and take an objective. There must be a reason.
Ask the Zampolites.
We are here to spread socialism and safeguard the future of our state and our country.
Shit!
Mirsky said, surprised at his vehemence. He hated the Zampolites. He had always hated all Zampolites, wherever he had served. As usual, the company's political officer, Major Bilizersky, was in the rear, issuing orders that sometimes conflicted with Mirsky's own.
Yes, fine, they've cooked the earth. So what are we to do? Abandon the fight and...
What?
Go home to ashes?
This time it would not be a little exercise in the schoolyard between hero and bully. It would be a flaming rubber-stamped skull and crossbones across the northern hemisphere.
That's what they're saying has happened.
Pletnyov backs them up. Surely we couldn't expect to take out their orbital defenses and have them kick their heels in the air and scream for mercy.
They are corrupt, Mirsky said. Weak and fearful.
Pavel, I do not like playing your Armenian voice of reality. You, of all people, should face facts and their implications. Do not underestimate the enemy. Do weak and decadent people march ahead of you in almost every sphere?
Oh, shut up and let me babble, Mirsky said, cradling his head between his hands.
He glanced up at the sergeant. Get out of here, he said wearily. Bring me good news or none at all.
Yes, sir, the sergeant said.
Pity we don't have any penal battalions to send on ahead to glorious sacrifice, Garabedian said. That's how we've won wars in the past.
Don't let Bilizersky hear you say that. I have enough trouble with him, and with you, as is.
We keep the bridge intact, Mirsky said. That's final. And we make our move in the next hour.
There was no arguing with Mirsky when he used that tone of voice. Garabedian paled slightly, then pulled out a stick of stale gum and inserted it into his mouth, savoring the sugar.
Mirsky's radio clicked softly. He keyed the receiver and acknowledged.
Comrade Commander, this is Bilizersky. Zev wishes to speak with you. In person.
Mirsky swore and replied that he would be there immediately.
More shambles, I think, he said to Garabedian.
26 hours into the stalemate, the results of the survey were brought into Gerhardt's makeshift command post. The lieutenant who had conducted the survey, a thin-faced man with deep-set eyes, delivered his findings in an Appalachian drawl.
We've peeped on every one of their positions and counted them from some distance, from the boreholes and from positions up the curve. They have 600 or so men still alive and moving, maybe 50 or 100 more we can't be positive about. They've lost a lot of senior officers, one general wounded or dead, and several colonels, at least one colonel in the second chamber, and two lieutenant colonels and a colonel in the first. There may be other generals. We've been hearing radio talk about Zev, Nev, and Lev. Some of us think they're talking about three generals.
Can you identify them? Lanier asked.
No, sir. They don't exactly have name badges on, but we think someone in the Russian science team might recognize a few. These troops have to be pretty highly trained, with lots of cosmonaut background, and they must have brushed up against some of the space people in the science team.
Do you have photos of the officers? Gerhardt asked the lieutenant.
Yes, sir. Most of them. Pretty clear ones, too. Couple of good profile shots.
Show them to the Russian science team members and see if we can get an identification.
Gary, I think you should mediate.
We'll talk to Pritikin on the Russian team. He's a straightforward fellow.
We'll let one of those heavy lifters dock, the one with Pletnyov. If he or Pritikin can get through to their senior officer by radio, and if he can arrange a meeting, maybe they'll do more than just listen to reason.
If I mediate, then I should know how to speak Russian, Lanier said. One of our fellows can help, Rimskaya, or that German lieutenant, Rudolf, or whatever, Jaeger.
Rimskaya's good, but perhaps not good enough for diplomatic nuances. Jaeger could be useful, but I won't take the job unless I work with the Russians directly, no insulation. I can take the 90 train into the third chamber and learn while you're arranging for Pletnyov to come aboard.
We don't have weeks, Gary.
Lanier shook his head. It won't be that long. Hours, perhaps. He took a deep breath and leaned forward. Do you see any reason not to put a stop to all the secrecy? Gerhardt thought for a moment.
Internally?
I'm not sure.
Wouldn't you like to know what all this is about?
Of course. I mean, I'm not sure who would authorize relaxing the restrictions.
Kirchner was told we were no longer part of Earth's military strategy. We're on our own. Can't we assume the same is true politically?
We're our own masters, you mean?
Exactly, Lanier said.
That's a can of worms I don't even want to peek into right now.
Well, I'll take responsibility for making one move, at least. The libraries are no longer closed. The information contained in them is available to everyone.
Even the Russians?
Even the Russians, if they negotiate for peace with us, Lanier said.
I'll learn Russian. You straighten out the negotiating procedures, and we'll offer them a share of all we have left.
Kirchner won't like letting the bastards dock, and he certainly won't like making concessions.
Who's in charge of internal security? Lanier asked pointedly.
And do we have any choice?
Patricia awoke to find the cabin in semi-darkness. She had rolled to face the window. More than 20 kilometers below, the corridor surface was dark and scarred. Great gashes crisscrossed the mottled ground, the edges shining dully. She rolled to look across the cabin. Her captor lay wrapped in a net of twinkling blue and green lights. Sparks shot between each light in the net, and within, his body was enveloped in a translucent greenish fog. She had enough weight in the cabin to feel the difference between up and down. Slipping out of her molded berth, she reached across to touch the net of lights and see if it was real. Before her fingers made contact, a voice stopped her.
Please do not disturb.
Olney stood at the front of the cabin. Patricia looked between the figure in the couch and the Olney that had just addressed her.
I am a partial personality, an assigned ghost.
Olney is resting, performing tacit meditation. If you have any business with him, please allow me to substitute.
What are you? Patricia asked.
An assigned ghost. While he rests, I perform any duties he may have which do not require physical activity. I have no substance. I am a projection.
Oh.
She frowned at the image.
What's he doing? What's happening to him?
Tacit meditation is the process of being surrounded by carriers of tacit data. His body is cleansed of impurities and his mind of obstacles to clear thought. Tacit data informs, reorganizes, criticizes the mental functions. It is a kind of dreaming.
Are you just a recording?
No. I am connected with his thought processes, but in a way that does not interfere with rest.
Where's the...
She was about to say boojum. She looked to the rear and saw the flat-headed, knock-kneed brown creature curled in its own berth, watching her with calm, slowly blinking eyes.
Hello, it said musically.
Patricia swallowed and nodded.
What was your name again?
I have no name. I am a Frant.
Who's piloting?
The ship controls itself at the moment. Surely you people have craft that can do that,
the Frant said, its tone admonishing.
Yes, of course.
She turned back to the image.
Why has the corridor changed?
Centuries ago there was a war here. The surface material brought into the way, the corridor, was severely disturbed. In places, you can see the way itself.
A war?
Patricia peered down at the mottled landscape.
Where Jarts occupied the way.
They had traveled from gates hundreds of thousands of kilometers farther down. Those gates have since been blocked or tightly regulated. When the Axis city attempted to pass and to regain control of the way, the Jarts resisted. They were driven out, and this stretch of the way, the entire distance to the Thistledown, is now blocked and deserted. Oh.
She lay back and watched the lights twinkle around Olmi. She was exhausted. Her eyes were sandy and her throat scratchy. Her chest ached and her arm and leg muscles were tense and sore.
I've been crying, she said.
You have slept for the last 12 hours, the Frant said. You seemed at peace while you slept. We did not disturb you.
Thank you, she said. This Axis City, that's where we're going?
Yes, the Frant said.
What will happen to me there?
You will be honored, Olmi's image answered. You are from our past, after all, and very brilliant.
I don't like fuss, Patricia said softly. And I want to go back and help my friends. They need me.
You are not crucial there, and we decided it was dangerous.
I still want to return. I want you to know you are taking me against my will.
We regret that. You will not be mistreated.
Patricia decided it was useless to argue with a ghost, assigned or otherwise. She wrapped her arms around her shoulders and watched the raked and blackened landscape far below. It was difficult to feel anything for the past now, for whatever had happened before she entered the craft. Did she really want to return? Was there anything so important to her anywhere? Yes. Lanier. He expected help from her. She was part of his team. And Paul, her family, dead. She felt for the letters in her pocket, and then reached for the bag containing the multimeter, slate, and processor. They had not been disturbed. Susnitskir was dying. Of the 5 corpsmen who had accompanied the battalion, 2 had made it into the second chamber, and they were in no mood to hide the facts from the general. 1, a small, balding, slight fellow with a bruise across half his face, took Mirska aside as he approached the copse of trees. The general has internal injuries, ruptured spleen the least among them. We don't have the blood or plasma we need, and we don't have the proper conditions for operating. He will die in an hour, maybe 2. He's strong, but he's no Superman. Sosnitsky lay on his side in a cot made out of backpack fabric and tree limbs. He blinked twice in succession every 2 or 3 seconds, and his face was pale and damp. Mirska kneeled beside him, and Sosnitsky took his hand. The general's grip was still surprisingly strong.
My own bones have become shrapnel, Comrade Commander, he said. I understand neither Lev nor Nev made it down.
He grimaced or grinned. It was difficult to tell which, then coughed.
I am about to confer a dubious honor on you, Colonel Mirsky. We need a division commander. The only other colonel left alive is Dyrgorsky, and I do not want a political officer in command of our troops. I am giving you a very big field promotion, comrade, one that may not be approved back on Earth. But then if what we hear is correct, on Earth nobody cares now. I have witnesses. Bilezerski here is one, and I will confirm the promotion by radio to other battalion commanders before I die. So I must work fast. You are now a lieutenant general. I give you my insignia.
He passed the stars to Mirsky with his right hand, face strained by the pain.
There might be trouble with others in line, but these are my wishes. I trust you, General Mirsky. If what our squadron commander says is true, and it does not seem impossible, then you must negotiate. We may be the last Russians. Everyone else burns. In fire.
He coughed again.
Until then, you hold your ground. But who am I to tell you what to do? You're a general now. Please tell Bilezerski to bring the radio.
Bilezerski passed with an angry look that had something else in it, a kind of pleading. He doesn't know how to treat me yet, Mirsky thought. The general made the announcement to his surviving staff. Bilezerski gently informed him that the borehole transponders were inoperative, but he insisted on radioing the message anyway.
The Americans know now that we will have a leader, he said.
Minutes later, he lapsed into coma. It took Mirsky some time to accept what had happened. He thought it best to continue as he had before, so he returned to the Foundation and conferred with Garabedian.
Despite setting his deadline, Yuska did not order any action at the end of the hour. He knew it would be suicide. He had had some vague hope of the heavy lifters suddenly coming through and beginning to drop, but the hope was gone now, and with it any real ambition to continue. Major General Sosnitsky was, of course, correct. From the very beginning, it had been an extremely risky gamble. If what the enemy said was true, and surely the squadron commander Pletnyov would not lie to his own men just to save his skin, if that was all true, no victory was possible. Garabedian approached with a tube of rations. Muska waved him aside. "We must eat," Garabedian said. "Comrade General." Muska frowned up at him. "Why? What use is it? They will keep us here till we starve or become foxes raiding the farmers' coops. We're stuck." Garabedian shrugged. "All right." Muska turned away from his former deputy and held out his arm abruptly, making grasping motions with his hand. "Give it to me, you bastard. I don't want you eating it." Garabedian grinned and passed him the tube. "It's lousy," Muska said, squeezing the fish paste into his mouth. "Tastes like shit." "In my hometown, we call shit sausage and fight over it," Garabedian said. "So why should you be depressed?" "I liked Sosnitsky," Muska said, "and then he goes and makes me a general." Chapter 31 Lanier stood in the broad, clear luminosity of the library, face twitching. He hadn't actually sat down before one of the chromium teardrops for months. He didn't wish to, even now. The experience had not been physically unpleasant, but it seemed that all his present troubles had emerged from one of those seats, the one now festooned with inactive equipment. Three Apple and Uzi-armed Marines stood uneasily behind him. Gerhardt had insisted they accompany Lanier in case any of the Russian Spetsnaz had this far infiltrated. He walked between the seats. Like Patricia, he eschewed the cluttered seat. He stopped and turned around to survey the plaza, then sat down on the chair and flipped open the control box. At the press of his fingers, queries floating before him, the library still addressed him in clear 21st century English. Perhaps it remembered him. Perhaps it knew who they were, even why they were here. "I need to learn 21st century Russian," he said. "Early 21st, pre-death. How long will that take?" "Do you wish a reading knowledge, speaking knowledge, colloquial facility, or all of these?" the library narrator asked. "I need speaking knowledge, colloquial, right away. I suppose the others as well, if it doesn't take much more time." "You can be taught a command of spoken colloquial and technical Russian in 2 hours. An additional hour will be required to teach you to read and translate." "Then give me all of it," he said. "Very well. Please relax. You are a little tense. We begin first with the Cyrillic alphabet." "I am relaxing," he realized with some surprise. As the lessons developed, he slipped into the bath of knowledge with a deep mental sigh. "I'm enjoying this." He had never had a talent for languages. Nevertheless, within 3 hours, he spoke Russian like a native Muscovite. Muscular, balding, and florid-faced squadron commander Lieutenant Colonel Sergei Alexeyevich Pletnyov and his four crew disembarked the tethered heavy lifter from the aft hatch and were guided into the first dock airlock. By the agreement negotiated several hours before, the remaining heavy lifters maintained their positions outside the borehole. The Russians removed their suits and were escorted by 7 apple-bearing Marines across the staging area and into the communications center. Kirchner greeted him, his words translated by Lieutenant Jaeger, and explained the procedure. "The senior officer for your men in the stone is in our second chamber, according to a message from your Major General Sosnitsky," Jaeger finished for him, translating. "Sosnitsky has promoted an officer named Mirsky to Lieutenant General. That means we have to negotiate passage across the first chamber. Your comrades have us blocked off here. Our only alternative is to fly you across the Axis, and I don't think anyone relishes that thought." Pletnyov listened to Lieutenant Jaeger and nodded vigorously. "I will speak to them again," he said, "this time directly. You don't have seniority over them. They may think you're a traitor."
I can only try, Fetnyov said. Perhaps I go down alone, or with my crew, and try to convince them.
They don't seem anxious to be convinced. Your transmissions have been broadcast to the troops, and they've continued fighting.
Yes, so? Fetnyov blustered, his face becoming even redder. We try again.
We try again, Kirchner agreed. First we'll let you transmit to the first chamber. Tell them everything. What our situation is here, what you plan on doing, what happened on Earth.
Yes, I am no idiot. That is what I will tell them.
He glared at Kirchner and then offered his hand again.
You butchered us, he said.
Kirchner hesitated, then shook the hand firmly.
Your men fight bravely.
Show me where to go now.
Pinckney suggested he follow her to a communications post. She pinned a wireless microphone to his lapel and tuned the equipment to a frequency used by the Russians.
Fetnyov spoke with a Lieutenant Colonel I.S. Pogodin in the first chamber. The German translated most of the rapid exchange for Kirchner.
You cannot have forgotten me, Pogodin. I instructed your class in Novosibirsk.
Yes, indeed, you sound like Fetnyov.
Lay down your fears, Pogodin. The battle is over. I need to cross your territory to speak with Colonel Mirsky, now Lieutenant General Mirsky. Will you allow?
He glanced at Kirchner.
Yourself, one of your crew, and an escort of four Marines, Kirchner said.
Two of us and four of them to cross?
There was no reply for a moment.
We have no communication with the second chamber, or any other chamber. Our own Colonel Roxakoff is dead. I am not senior officer in this chamber. There is Colonel Vyrgorsky.
Then get together with Vyrgorsky and make a decision, Pogodin.
There was a few minutes' wait until Vyrgorsky came back with a reply.
You may cross unarmed. I will want to speak with you in person.
Fetnyov cast a querying look at Kirchner.
Unarmed? Is that acceptable?
Kirchner nodded.
We will come down then
by the zero elevator to the science team compound, Kirchner instructed, and the German translated.
We'll need a truck released from the compound to cross the chamber.
Fetnyov passed on the requirements. Vyrgorsky added that one of his men must accompany them in the truck to the second chamber. After a moment's consideration, Kirchner again agreed. He then spoke with Gerhardt and confirmed the plan.
Lanier and two of my men will be on the opposite side of the bridge as soon as we reach an agreement with whoever's in charge of the second chamber, Gerhardt said. Lanier's learned Russian. We think one of the Russian science team should go with him, too, if everyone's agreeable.
Fetnyov pursed his lips and mumbled something the German could not understand. Then, in passable English, he asked,
Please, is there washroom? I have occupied suit for a week now.
Bilizersky crouched beside Mirsky as the ceasefire instructions were relayed over the loudspeaker in the enemy camp.
This could be very tricky, Bilizersky said, shaking his head. We cannot be sure what sort of misinformation they will bring.
Mirsky did not react. He listened intently, then passed orders through Garabedian for his battalion to heed the instructions.
Fetnyov will be here in an hour, he said, as he took a cigarette offered by Garabedian. We can question him to our heart's content. If what he says is indeed true, then we negotiate.
There must be no retreat from principles, Bilizersky said grimly.
Who suggested retreat from anything, Mirsky countered. He disliked the little martinet with his tight-pressed lips and nervous gestures.
If Fetnyov tells the truth, Bilizersky pursued, then we must establish a stronghold of the revolution right here, on the potato.
They call it the stone, Garabedian said.
The potato,
Bilizersky repeated, glaring at him.
No one disputes you, Mirsky said with perhaps too much patience.
We must be equal partners in this venture.
They have all the women, Mirsky observed. Bilizersky scrutinized him as if he had made a bad joke.
Yes, Comrade General, I do not see...
We cannot go home. If Fetnyov is correct, Mirsky said, to carry on the ideals of the revolution, there must be women. That seems obvious.
Bilizersky had nothing to say to this.
Perhaps on our science team, Garabedian suggested.
Most of them are men, Mirsky observed,
Remember the briefings? Very prestigious assignment, the potato. Senior academicians and their assistants only. Maybe 15 women. Spread among 700 soldiers. He laughed and squashed the quickly smoked cigarette butt against the concrete foundation. Bielozerski sat with his back against the concrete and stared down at his clasped hands, where they rested on drawn-up knees. "Not everything in Russia has been destroyed," he murmured. "There are redoubts, fortresses. You have heard of these, Comrade General, surely." "They reveal nothing to those who do not need to know," Miuska said. "Rumors don't equal reality." "But at Podlivki, the secret hangars, the helicopters and airplanes waiting, surely the party secretary, the defense council." "Perhaps," Miuska said, more to shut the man up than to agree. "They will communicate with us then." Bielozerski looked up, eyes bright. "We must have our own outside channel of communication. If we negotiate, we must demand..." "I have thought of that already," Miuska said. "Now please be quiet. I have a lot of thinking to do before Pletnyov arrives." The truck rolled past the lines of foxholes and the barbed wire fences scavenged from the science compound. Russians in incongruous Arctic camouflage peered at them, some still wearing their spacesuit helmets. The suits themselves had long since been discarded. They littered the drop zones in the first chamber, along with the parasails and bodies of unlucky soldiers. "Never such an action as this," Pletnyov said flatly. "Never." Major Onyankovsky, the representative of the Russians in the first chamber, stared sadly through the truck windows and ran his hands through brick-red hair. "I am grateful to be alive," he said. Lieutenant Rudolf Jaeger translated for the two Marine escorts in a low voice. The truck passed through the checkpoint by its demolished guardhouse and headed north. At the northern end of the Zero Bridge, Lanier glanced at his watch. 1,400 hours. The Marines nodded to each other, and they began crossing on foot as agreed. "I just hope those damn insurgents got the word," the young sergeant said, looking back at Alexandria. Through cameras in the first chamber borehole opening, Kirchner monitored the progress of the truck on the same console that had conveyed photos of Earth's death just 30 hours before. Behind him, Link jerked up in her seat and quickly tuned in a signal. "Incoming OTV," advised one of the soldiers on watch in the exterior dimple. "Not a Russian, one of ours." Link gestured with one hand, the other punching buttons in rapid succession. "Captain Kirchner, we have an OTV from Station 16. It's damaged and couldn't go to Lunar Settlement." "Sir, they say they have Judith Hoffman on board." Kirchner swiveled in his chair. "I'm not surprised," he said laconically. "Bring him in. Miss Pickney, where did I leave my jacket?" Chapter 32 Mirsky crossed the field slowly, not so much out of caution as to display his dignity and to gain some idea of their losses. Lanier, Lieutenant Jaeger, Major Onyankovsky, and Pletnyov advanced more rapidly until only a few yards separated them. Pletnyov stepped forward to grasp Mirsky's hand and upper arm, then backed away, standing alone. Mirsky looked at the bodies spaced haphazardly on the field. Two lay half in and half out of an unfinished foxhole, several small burned holes and slashes of cooked flesh showing through melted gaps in their uniforms. He had counted 28 corpses so far. There were at least twice that many on the field. His thoughts strayed away from tactical considerations and lingered on the unsimple fact of dead countrymen. The 41 wounded in the second chamber were being tended by only two corpsmen. Sosnitsky had died the day before, never emerging from coma. The wounded died 2, 3, and 4 daily. Mirsky turned to Pletnyov. "What they have broadcast to us, your words, your information, it is true?" "Yes," Pletnyov said. "Were there any instructions from Earth?" "No." "And how bad?" "It is very bad," Pletnyov said softly, scratching his cheek. "There will be no victors." "No instructions from anywhere? From the Defense Council in a redoubt? From the party? A platform? From some surviving officers?" Pletnyov shook his head. "Nothing. They could not be concerned with us." "Did you witness engagements?" Mirsky asked, his face tightening.
We saw Russia glowing at night. All of Europe is on fire.
Which one of you speaks Russian? Mirska asked sharply, glancing at Lanier and Jaeger.
We both do, Lanier said.
Are your countries victorious, then?
No, Lanier said.
We are all pigs, Mirska said.
Pletnyov shook his head. We did our duty, Comrade General. You have accomplished a marvelous...
How many ships survived? Mirsky interrupted.
Four, Pletnyov said. And how many men? Lanier, Jaeger, and Major Onyankovsky waited for Mirsky to respond.
200.
No, about 180 here. Mirsky frowned at Lanier. I haven't heard how many in the other chambers. Maybe 700 in all. General Sosnitsky died yesterday.
Then you are the senior officer, Pletnyov said.
We should begin talks now, Lanier said. I don't see any need to resume fighting.
No, Mirsky said.
He surveyed the field, shaking his head slowly. If we are all that is left, no need to fight.
Earth is not dead, Colonel, Lanier said. It is very badly hurt, but it is not dead.
You sound certain, Mirsky said.
How can you be so sure?
Yes, Pletnyov said in English.
So you have communication with your superiors?
No, Lanier said. I read about it and watched it happen. It's a long story, General Mirsky, and I think the time has come to make it known to everybody.
While the bodies still lay where they had fallen, the Russians were guaranteed access to the first four chambers in return for guaranteeing the Western Bloc personnel access to the compounds and zero elevator in the first chamber. Promises were made that bilateral security squads would police the travel routes. With that agreed to, the debris and bodies were cleared from the southern cap and the borehole, and the remaining Russian heavy lifters were given permission to dock. The negotiations were conducted in the first chamber, in the first science team compound cafeteria. Half of the second compound barracks was temporarily given over to house Russian soldiers. A line drawn in white paint divided the sectors and was guarded on one side by five Marines, on the other by five tired-looking space shock troopers. Eventually, the Russians indicated, they would move most of their soldiers out of the first chamber and claim a large section of the fourth chamber. Gerhard spoke through Lanier and Jaeger to Mirsky. Colonel Vyogorsky, a darkly handsome middle-aged man with jet-black hair and green eyes, advised Mirsky on political considerations. Major Bilizersky was always lurking nearby. The third political officer, Major Yazykov, was assigned to the fourth chamber, part of a Russian survey team. They worked through the early evening of the second day of the truce. During a break for coffee and lunch, Kirchner appeared in the cafeteria entrance with a guest and two guards. Lanier looked up at the group and slowly lowered his cup of coffee.
"Looks like you don't need much help," Judith Hoffman said. She was pale and her hair was uncharacteristically mussed. She wore an outsized jumpsuit and one of her hands was wrapped in a bandage. In the other, she carried a personal effects box from the shuttle. Without a word, Lanier pushed back his chair and crossed the room to wrap her in a tight hug. The Russians watched with mild irritation at the interruption. Vyogorsky whispered something to Mirsky, and he nodded, sitting up in his seat.
"Jesus," Lanier said softly. "I was sure you hadn't made it. You don't know how good it is to see you."
"As good as it feels to be here, I hope. The President fired me and the whole board 4 days before... I pulled in some favors and took a VIP tour of Station 16 the next day. I was arranging for an OTV flight. Not easy. I was persona non grata with the politicos, and that worried the brass, but two shuttle jocks were willing to smuggle me aboard. We were all fueled and ready to go when the war began, and we got away with six civilian evacuees just before they..." She swallowed.
"I'm very tired, Gary, but I had to see you and let you know I'm here. Not as your boss, just here. There are nine others, four women, two men, three crew. Let me sleep and then tell me how I can help."
"We haven't worked out chain of command yet. We don't even know whether we're an outpost or a territory or a nation," Lanier said. "There'll be plenty for you to do." His eyes were watering. He wiped them with the back of his hand and grinned at Hoffman, then pointed to the bargaining table. We're talking. The fighting's over. For now. Perhaps for good.
I always knew you were a good administrator, Hoffman said.
Gary, I have to sleep. I haven't had a good sleep since we left the station.
But I brought something with me.
She put the box on the table and undid the metal clasps. Raising the top, she dumped the packets of seeds across the tabletop. Some slid over to the Russian table. Mirsky and Vyagorsky seemed stunned by the display. Mirsky picked up a packet of marigold seeds.
Please, keep what you want, Hoffman told them.
She looked up at Lanier.
They're for all of us now.
Kirchner took her by the elbow and led her away. Lanier returned to the table and sat, feeling magnitudes better. Bilizersky, standing behind Yogorsky and Mirsky, looked down on the pile of seeds with unconcealed suspicion.
My chief political officer wants to know if you have received instructions from any surviving governmental organization, Mirsky said.
Jaeger translated for Gerhardt.
No, Lanier said. We're still operating on our own.
We recognize the woman you spoke to, Vyagorsky said smoothly. She is an agent of your government and the perpetrator of your policies on this asteroid.
Yes, she is, Lanier said. And when she's feeling better, she'll join our negotiations.
But she was, he searched for the word, removed from her position before the death.
He wondered at how easily that word came, designating past, not future.
When did she arrive? Mirsky asked.
I don't know. Not too long ago.
We insist, Bilizersky said, that any Warsaw Pact survivors be welcomed on this asteroid as well, military and civilian.
Of course, Lanier said.
Gerhardt agreed with a nod.
And now, Lanier said, for perhaps the most important issues, disarmament and territorial rights.
We will work out a rough draft of these agreements and ratify a formal document later, Mirsky said.
We insist on sovereignty of all Warsaw Pact peoples on this asteroid, Bilizersky said.
Vyagorsky pursed his lips. Mirsky backed his chair away from the table sharply and led Bilizersky to a corner. There they engaged in a quiet but heated exchange, with Bilizersky casting furious glances at Lanier and Gerhardt. Mirsky returned alone.
I am in command of Soviet soldiers and citizens, he said. I am the principal negotiator.
Lanier's office and bunk room had been ransacked, but not seriously damaged during the occupation. He slept for 5 hours, and then took a rationed breakfast from the food vendor in the cafeteria. Kirchner met him at the front entrance of the women's barracks.
I'm going back to the borehole, he said. There's still an unholy mess up there. We're bringing down bodies now, ours and theirs. Is there a service scheduled?
I've suggested a single service sometime in the next 24 hours. More than just mourning for the dead here.
Kirchner pursed his lips. It's not going to be easy standing around those bastards.
Has to start somewhere.
How's Hoffman? Has she slept?
From what I've heard, two of your astronomers took her in and kicked me and the guards out.
He narrowed his eyes and nodded in the direction of the cafeteria.
What's my role going to be when you fellows are done?
Captain USN, I presume, Lanier said. In charge of external security. I'm not going to hand them the stone on a plate.
Have they agreed to disarm?
Lanier shook his head.
Not yet. They want to set up a secure camp in the fourth chamber. Then they'll discuss disarmament. I'm giving Mirsky a private tour later this afternoon. The libraries, the cities.
Jesus, I'd like to go with you.
You'll get your chance soon. As far as Gerhardt and I are concerned, it's all open. No monopoly.
Even the seventh chamber?
In time. They haven't asked about that yet.
Kirchner raised his eyebrows. Weren't they told?
I have no idea what they tell their military men. Certainly they'll know pretty soon. The Russian science team is not exactly mixing with the soldiers. Military doesn't count for much in their eyes, apparently. But word will get around.
He paused for a long moment.
Any word from Earth?
Not a thing. Some radar activity in the Arctic Ocean. Maybe a few surface ships. Can't see much. Smoke is covering most of Europe, Asia, the United States,
They can't be concerned with us, Gary. Kirshner walked across the compound and climbed into a truck, going to the zero elevator entrance. Lanier knocked on the barracks door. Janice Polk answered. "Come on in," she said. "She's awake, and I took her some food a few minutes ago." Hoffman sat on the couch in the small lounge. Beryl Wallace and Lieutenant Doreen Cunningham, former head of compound security, sat on chairs across from her. Cunningham's head was bandaged, evidence of the laser burn she had received before the surrender of the first compound. They stood as Lanier entered. Cunningham made as if to salute, then smiled sheepishly and lowered her hand. "Ladies, Mr. Lanier and I have some catching up to do," Hoffman said, placing a half-full glass of orange juice on the tank baffle table. When they were alone, Lanier sat and pulled the chair closer. "I think I'm ready for a briefing," Hoffman said. "I haven't heard anything since I left Earth. Was it like what the libraries showed us?"
"Yes," Lanier said. "And the long winter is starting."
"Okay."
She pinched her nose with two fingers and rubbed it vigorously.
"End of the world. All that we know."
She sighed, and the sigh threatened to shudder into a sob.
"Shit.
First things first." Lanier held out his hand, and she shook it.
"They'll think we're lovers," she said.
"A purely Dracarian relationship," Lanier said. She laughed and wiped her eyes with a handkerchief.
"How are you doing, Gary?" she asked.
He didn't answer for a long moment. "I lost my aircraft, Judith. I was in charge."
"Bull."
"I was in charge, and I did everything I could to prevent the war. I failed, so I can't really say how I am just yet. Maybe not too well. I don't know. I'm giving them tit for tat in the negotiations, but I'm very tired." She tapped his hand with her fingers and nodded slowly, her eyes fixed on his.
"Okay. You still have my full confidence. You know that, Gary?"
"Yes."
"After things settle down, we can all take our turn sticking our heads through the hole in the Sisyphus mural. Now tell me about the invasion and everything that's happened since."
Lanier had a vague daydream of taking Mirsky to the second chamber library alone, or with at most only one bodyguard apiece. When he arrived at the cafeteria negotiating tables, Mirsky, Garabedian, two of the three surviving political officers, Bilizersky and Major Yazykov, and four armed SSTs awaited him. He quickly asked Gerhardt and Jaeger to accompany him, and to balance the forces, four Marines joined the group. They rode in silence from the first chamber to the second chamber's zero bridge. One of Mirsky's troopers drove the truck for the first half of the short journey. Mirsky glanced at Lanier several times during the trip through the city, sizing him up, Lanier suspected. The Russian lieutenant general was a closed book to Lanier. Not once had Mirsky revealed any of his private side. Still, Lanier had a much higher regard for Mirsky than for Bilizersky. Mirsky might listen to reason. Bilizersky wouldn't even know what reason was. Halfway across the bridge, the truck stopped, and a Marine took over the driving duties. They passed through the shopping district Patricia had described as quaint, and then disembarked in the library plaza. One Marine and one SST stayed behind to guard the truck. They squared off at opposite corners of the vehicle and studiously avoided conversation. Gerhardt engaged Bilizersky in conversation through Jaeger. This gave Lanier an opportunity to lead Mirsky a few steps ahead and prepare him for what they would find. "I'm not sure what your commanders told you about the stone," he began, "but I doubt you have the complete story." Mirsky stared ahead stonily. "The stone is a better name than the potato," he admitted, lifting his eyebrows. "Calling it the potato makes us worms, no? I have been told the stone was built by humans."
"That's not the half of it."
"Then I am interested to hear the rest." Lanier told him the story in some detail as they entered the library and climbed the stairs to the second floor. In the reading room, Lanier found a section of Russian volumes in the stacks and emerged with three, handing one to Mirsky, a translation of The Brief History of the Death, and one each to Bilizersky and Yazykov. Bilizersky stood with his book firmly clutched in both hands, staring at Lanier as if he had been insulted. "What is this supposed to be?" he asked.
Yazykov opened his volume hesitantly.
Read it for yourself, Lanier suggested.
It is Dostoevsky, Bidazersky said. He traded books with Yazykov. And Uksakov. These are supposed to interest us?
Perhaps if you would look at the printing dates, gentlemen, Lanier said quietly.
They opened their books, read, and then closed them sharply, almost together.
We must explore these shelves thoroughly, Bidazersky said. He did not sound happy at the prospect.
Mieska held his book open in both hands, thumbing through it and returning several times to the publication notice, once touching the date with his finger. He closed the book on his thumb and tapped its spine on the surface of the reading table, looking up at Lanier. The second chamber library seemed, if anything, darker and gloomier than before.
This tells the history of the war, Mieska half asked, half stated. It is an accurate translation of the English edition?
I believe so.
Gentlemen, Mr. Lanier and I must be alone for a few minutes. Comrade officers, you will please wait with General Gerhardt and his men, and you will take our men with you.
Bidazersky placed the book on an empty reading table, and Yazykov followed suit.
You should not be long, Comrade General, Bidazersky said.
As long as it takes, Mieska said.
Lanier had brought along a canteen half filled with brandy, hopeful of just such an opportunity. He now poured out a cup for each of them.
This is much appreciated, Mieska said, lifting the cup.
Special service, Lanier said.
My political officers would accuse you of trying to get me drunk and
pump me, that is the idiom, for information.
There's not enough left to get drunk on, Lanier said.
Pity. I am not strong enough for this.
Mieska gave the library two widely spaced jabs with the empty cup.
Maybe you are, but I am not. It frightens me to death.
You'll find strength after a while, Lanier said. It's as attractive as it is frightening.
You have known this for how long?
2 years.
I think I will let others find the attraction, Mieska said. My people will now have access to all this, unrestricted. Any of us? The soldiers and officers, too?
That's the agreement.
How did you learn to speak Russian? In school?
In the third chamber library, Lanier said. It took me just over 3 hours.
You speak like a Muscovite. One who has been overseas for a few decades, perhaps, but still a Muscovite.
Could I learn English that quickly?
Probably.
Lanier split the last of the brandy and they toasted each other.
You are a strange man, Gary Lanier, Mieska said solemnly.
Oh?
Yes. You are turned inside. You see others, but don't let them see you.
Lanier did not react.
There, see? Mieska grinned. You are that way.
The Russian's eyes suddenly resumed their sharp focus on him.
Why didn't you let the world know about this from the beginning?
After you've spent a little more time here, and in the third chamber, ask yourself what you would have done.
It was Mieska's turn not to react.
There are bitter grievances between our people, he said, dropping the book on the table with a thump. They will not be easily laid to rest. In the meantime, I do not understand this place. I do not understand our position here, or yours. My ignorance is dangerous, Mr. Lanier, so I will come here, or to the other library, when time permits, and educate myself. And I will learn English using your method, if that is possible. But, to prevent confusion, I do not think all my people will be allowed to come here. Would it not be wise for you to look to similar restrictions?
Lanier shook his head, wondering if Mieska even saw his own contradictions.
We are here to break the pattern of the past, not continue it. As far as I am concerned, it's open to all.
Mieska stared at him for an uncomfortably long period of time, then stood.
Perhaps, he said. That is much easier for you to say than for me. My people are not used to being well informed. Some of my officers will find the thought frightening. Some will not believe any of this. They will assume it is an American trick. That would be very comforting.
But you know it isn't.
Mieska reached out to touch the book.
If a truth is dangerous, he said,
then perhaps it is not true enough. The strip of parkland in the second chamber where Mirsky's battalion had landed now took the bodies of the dead. 106 American, British, and German soldiers had died in the battle and lay in aluminized sacks down a long trench opened by one of the anthropology team's excavators. 362 Soviets lay in four more trenches. Another 98 Soviets and a dozen Western Bloc soldiers were missing and presumed dead, either destroyed in the battle or drifted out of the borehole to become freeze-dried mummies in orbit around the stone. A special marker had been set up for the dead of OTV-45 and the crews of the lost heavy lifters. 2,300 people gathered around the trenches. Mirska and Gerhardt spoke in Russian and English, keeping their words brief and to the point. They were burying more than just their fellows, though there was no marker yet for the dead of Earth. They were burying distant family members, friends, distant cultures, histories, dreams. They were burying the past, for as much of it as they could part with. The Soviets stood together in ranks. Within the Soviet group, the members of their science team remained isolated, selected out. The Soviets stood in silence as a chaplain cook and Yitzhak Jacob, acting as a rabbi, administered last rites and Kaddish. The Soviet Uzbek Muslim stepped forward to offer his prayers. Mirsky threw the first spade of dirt into the Soviet graves. Gerhardt threw a spadeful into the NATO grave. Then, without planning or warning, Gerhardt took a shovel of dirt from the mound to be pushed over his men and carried it to the first Soviet trench. Mirsky did the same without hesitation. Bielozersky watched with a face permanently locked in disapproval. Yogorsky kept a silent, dignified demeanor. Gazikov seemed to be somewhere else, and his eyes were moist. Hoffman and Farley stepped forward and laid a wreath at the head of each site. As the crowd moved away, the archaeology team immediately began filling in the trenches. The Soviets divided to return to the first and fourth chambers. Farley, Carrollson, and Hoffman joined Lanier and Heinemann at the Zero Bridge. They watched people crossing to go to the train terminals. Carrollson edged closer to Lanier and touched his arm. "Gary, there's something we have to talk about." "Let's hear it," he said. "Not here, in the compound," Carrollson said, looking to Hoffman. They gathered in the trucks and crossed the first chamber. Carrollson, Farley, Heinemann, and Hoffman accompanied Lanier to the deserted administration building, where they gathered around Ann Blakely's desk on the first floor. "Sounds like bad news coming," he said. His eyes widened in prescient realization. "Oh, my God," he said. "Where's..." Carrollson interrupted him. "You've been too busy until now. We're not sure what's happened, but Patricia can't be found anywhere. There are two reports, but one's Russian, and it may not be credible. Rimskaya heard it when he was talking with the Russian science team. The other's from Larry. We thought we'd find her, that maybe she was just hiding out somewhere, but..." Heinemann nodded. "What I saw just seems to add to the mystery," he said. "Patricia left the fourth chamber compound last Wednesday," Farley said. "Nobody saw her go, but Lenore is convinced she must have taken a train to the third chamber. She said she was going to a library. We were all a little crazy then, and she was taking it very hard," Carrollson said. "The Russian team says that a Soviet soldier saw an aircraft land near one of the subway terminals in Thistledown, on the northern side, the Zero Line terminal," Farley said. "Two people got aboard, and something the Russian called a devil. One of the humans was a man, and the other a woman, and the woman fits Patricia's description. The aircraft flew off, white, spade-shaped, but with the nose blunted. It didn't make any noise." Heinemann stepped forward. "I saw a Bujum go past when I was down the corridor. Arrowhead-shaped, blunt nose. It was traveling in a spiral around the plasma tube, heading north." "There hasn't been time until now to put it all together," Carrollson said. "I'm sorry about the delay." "It doesn't make sense," Lanier said, shaking his head. "Maybe she was just captured by the Russians. Maybe..." "Rimsky has asked around. He thinks not," Carrollson said. "There wasn't anybody in Thistledown but a few Soviet paratroopers off course. No diversionary troops, none of our troops, not at that time. Nobody but Patricia." "And the Bujum," Heinemann said. "The coincidence is too close, Gary." He continued to shake his head. It's over. Please, I just can't handle much more, he said. Judith, tell them. I can't do anything now. There's the negotiations and the... Of course, Hoffman said, gripping his shoulder firmly with one hand. Let's all get some rest. Lanier held one hand to his face, as if to smooth the deep bruise of anguish around his mouth. I'm supposed to take care of her, he said. She's important. Judith, you told me to take care of her. It's all right. There wasn't anything.
God damn this place, Judith!
He raised his fists and shook them helplessly.
I hate this fucking rock!
Carrollson began to cry. Farley held her. Not just you, Carrollson said. You put her in my charge. Stop it, Hoffman said, quietly, looking away. Heinemann stood back, embarrassed and uncertain what to do. I'm not going to just give up on her, Lanier said, lowering his arms and opening and closing his hands. She's not just gone. Larry, can we have the tube-rider fueled and ready to go soon? Anytime you give the word. Judith, I think you chose wrong, Lanier said.
I don't think so. What do you mean?
I'm not going to see it through. I'm going to run off on a foolish rescue mission, not stay here and argue with a bunch of Soviets. You know me. You know I'm going to do that.
Okay, she said. You'll go after her. There are other reasons.
What? Lanier asked. We're stuck here, aren't we? Hoffman said. We have to find out what's down there soon, anyway. Larry, does the V-stole work? The tube rider? They work fine, Heinemann said. Then we'll plan. But we'll do it carefully. Is that okay, Gary? Not right away, but soon? Okay, Lanier said meekly. I think we all need to relax and eat and rest, Farley said, looking around for agreement. They stood in silence, a bit shaken by how close to the edge Lanier had come, and by the realization of how close they all were.
I'd like to go too, Carrollson said.
Chapter 33. So I suppose you want to get away from it all. Feel like it's very remote.
Yes.
Go chasing down the corridor after her. Why? To save my goddamn soul, that's why. You haven't done badly. The earth is in ruins. The stone is half occupied by surly Russians, and I've lost the one person I was specifically told to protect. But the stone is still here, and the situation seems to be stabilizing. Belozersky, Yazykov, Vyogorsky. Old liners. Hardliners. Yes, they're trouble, and shouldn't you stick around to blunt their particular axes?
No.
You'll leave Hoffman with all the problems.
She'll let me go because she knows I'm at the end of my rope. I can't take any more. I'm of no use to her or the stone, except to go find Patricia.
Lanier opened his eyes and looked at his wristwatch. 07:50 hours. He felt paralyzed. The voices continued in his head, back and forth. His mind was trying to cope with the intolerable and to find his place in a new situation. He kept thinking of Earth, of people, friends, co-workers, perhaps the very people he had met a few weeks before, crawling through the rubble. Very likely there was not a single person alive on Earth whom he knew personally. That was good statistics, but a lousy thought, lousy psychology. Most of his contacts, his people, had lived in cities or worked in military centers. One exception was Robert Tyheimer, a submarine commander. He had been married to Lanier's sister, who had died of a stroke 2 years before Lanier was assigned to the stone. They hadn't talked since a year after her death. Tyheimer might still be alive, under the ice, waiting. If he hadn't already contributed to the general destruction, then Tyheimer would guard his warheads and wait, and wait, for the next exchange, for the final blows. I hate you, Lanier said out loud, eyes closed again. He didn't even know whom he meant. Three psychiatrists gathered in his head and discoursed. One, a cliché Freudian, always twisted the worst and most sordid interpretation out of his every fleeting glimmer of thought. Yes, and your mother. And what did you say then? Met yourself, didn't you? Another sat quietly, smiling, letting him hang himself in his own ropey confusions. And the third nodded and recommended work therapy. The third resembled his father. That interested the first. He turned over in the bed and opened his eyes again. No sleep, no rest. How long would it take for the people on the stone to crack? How many, and how seriously? Who would contend with the problem, himself or Hoffman? But the decision had already been made. He had given Hoffman the grand tour, and had encountered Mirsky in the third chamber library, sitting before a teardrop. The Russian lieutenant general had been accompanied by three bodyguards, even though the library was otherwise empty. He had appeared exhausted, and ignored them. Showing Hoffman to a seat some distance away from the Russians, Lanier had taught her how to use the facilities. He had passed the keys to her, and she had welcomed them. He sat up and flipped on the intercom. Ann Blakely was back at her desk and still in charge of the central switchboard. "I can't sleep," he said. "What's Heinemann's schedule now?"
"He's awake, if that's what you want to know," she said.
"Fine. And in the seventh chamber, no doubt?"
"No. Schedule here says staging area in the southern borehole."
"Call him, please."
"Will do."
"Tell him I want to leave tomorrow, early. 800 hours.
"Yes, sir."
The crew of the V-Stole had already been chosen. Himself, Heinemann, Carrollson, perhaps the only one Hoffman would have difficulty doing without, and Karen Farley. The mission was simple and direct. They would travel a maximum of 1,000,000 kilometers down the corridor, assuming it extended that far, stopping at several points along the way and descending to the floor. Who knew what the nature of the corridor would be that far north? They would then return, with or without Patricia, or any evidence of her whereabouts. There were a lot of uncertainties, but they were of a type Lanier welcomed. He had been dealing with horrors for so long that a sleek, cleanly dangerous adventure seemed like heaven. He dressed and gathered his personal kit into a little black bag. Toothbrush, razor, change of underwear, slate with package of memory blocks. Toothbrush. Lanier started to laugh. The laughter seemed forced, but it gathered in waves until he was helpless. He lay on the bunk and doubled up, his face knotting painfully. Finally, he stopped, gasping, and then thought of the tiny lavatory on the aircraft with its tiny shower. He thought of taking a crap as they rode the Singularity, and the laughter broke out anew. Minutes passed before he could control it, and then he sat up straight on the edge of the bunk, taking deep breaths and rubbing his sore jaw and cheek muscles. "God in heaven," he sighed, and stuffed the toothbrush into the little black bag. The dead Soviet trooper floated 20 meters from the research scaffold in the seventh chamber borehole. How he had gotten so far was anybody's guess. He did not seem to have been wounded. Perhaps he had feared the fall and stayed near the axis until his air gave out. He was slowly drifting back down the borehole toward the sixth chamber. There wasn't enough time to snag him and bring him down. He cast a tangible gloom over the farewells. He seemed to watch with great interest, his pale face visible behind the faceplate, eyes wide. Hoffman hugged Lanier, Carrollson, and then Farley, their bulky suits interfering with the intent, if not the emotion. Heinemann was already aboard the V-Stole, which was attached, Remora-like, to the tube writer. They stood around the blunt end of the Singularity for a moment, silent, and Hoffman said,
"Gary, this isn't a wild goose chase. You know that. We need that little Chicana. Whoever took her away from us may have known how much we need her. Of course, I'm suspicious by nature. At any rate, you folks are on a very important mission. Godspeed."
Farley turned toward Hoffman.
"We reached a decision last night. Hua Ling and the rest of us, all the Chinese. It wasn't to be announced until this evening, but nobody will object if I tell you now. We are with the Western Bloc. The Soviet science team made some overtures, but we decided to support you. I think the Soviet scientists wish they could follow our lead, but I just wanted you to know before we left."
"Thank you," Hoffman said, gripping Farley's glove.
"We'll be curious. No need to tell you that. Learn all you can. There's a few hundred or more of us who wish we could go along."
"That's why I volunteered first," Carrollson said. "Time's a-wastin'," Heinemann drawled. "All aboard."
"Shut up and let us be sentimental," Carrollson scolded him. Everything will be fine, Hoffman told Lanier, as they hugged again and held each other back to peer through faceplates.
Let's go, Lanier said.
They hooked their safety lines to a long pole stretched out near the aircraft and kicked away, one by one, to enter the hatch. Two people fit into the airlock. They cycled twice, Lanier waiting until last. With the hatch sealed and air pressure restored, he removed his suit and folded it into the compartment beneath the airlock controls. With only four passengers, the aircraft interior was spacious. The forward part of the cabin was filled with boxes of scientific equipment. Carrollson and Farley checked them out before strapping in. Lanier joined Heinemann in the cockpit. All fuel and oxygen cables clear, Heinemann said, checking the instruments. I've run the diagnostics on the tube rider. Everything's go. He looked expectantly at Lanier.
Then go, Lanier said.
Heinemann swung out the pylon which held the tube rider controls and locked it before him. Hang on, he said. Then over the intercom, ladies, barf bags are in the pouches of the seat in front of you. Not suggesting, you understand. He depressed the clamp controls. Slowly, smoothly, the tube rider began to slide along the slender silver pipe of the singularity. A little more, he said. Lanier felt himself pressed back into his seat. And a little more still. They were heavy now, lying on their backs in a cockpit and cabin suddenly upended. Last bit, Heinemann said, and they effectively weighed half again more than they would have on Earth. There's a rope ladder I'll unroll down the aisle, just in case anybody has to go to the bathroom. He grinned at Lanier. I don't recommend the lavatory in these conditions. We didn't get enough specs to design for comfort. I'll let up on the clamps if anyone gets desperate.
Count on it, Carrollson said from the cabin.
Lanier watched the corridor moving slowly, majestically, around them. Through the windscreen, the floor of the corridor merged in the distance with the pearly central glow of the plasma tube, stretching perhaps forever. The ultimate escape, isn't it? Heinemann asked, as if reading his thoughts. Makes me feel young again. Chapter 34. After three separate occasions where Olney wrapped himself in his isolating net of lights, Patricia decided there was something faintly unsavory about Talcott. Perhaps it was addictive, whatever it was. They had been flying for at least 3 days, perhaps as many as five, and while Olney and the Frant were unfailingly polite and answered her questions with seeming sincerity, they were not exactly voluble. She spent much of her time sleeping fitfully, dreaming about Paul. She often touched his last letter, still in the breast pocket of her jumpsuit. Once she awoke screaming and saw the Frant jerk spasmodically in its berth. Olney had half fallen from his couch and was staring at her with evident alarm. Sorry, she said, looking between them guiltily. Quite all right, Olney said. We wish we could help. We could, actually, but... He didn't finish. A few minutes later, when her heart had stopped racing and she realized she couldn't remember what had made her scream, she asked Olney what he meant by saying they could help. Talcott, he said. Smooths the memory, rearranges priorities without dulling memory, blocks subconscious access to certain disturbing memories. After Talcott, such memories can only be opened by direct conscious will. Oh, Patricia said. Why can't I have some of this Talcott? Olney smiled and shook his head. You're pure, he said. I'd be reprimanded if I brought you into our culture before our scholars had a chance to study you. Sounds like I'm a specimen, Patricia said. The Frant again made that sound of amplified teeth grinding. Olney looked at it reproachfully and swung down from his berth. You are, of course, Olney said. What would you like to eat? I'm not hungry, Patricia said, lying back in her couch. I'm frightened, and I'm bored, and I'm having bad dreams. The Frant peered down at her, its large brown eyes unblinking. It held out one hand, spread its four slender fingers, and curled them again. Please, it said, its voice like a badly tuned calliope. I cannot help. A Frant always wishes to help, Olney explained. If it cannot help, it feels pain. I'm afraid you're quite a trial to my Frant.
Your Frant? You own him?
It. No, I don't own him.
For the time of our assignment, we are duty-wed, rather like social symbionts. I share its thoughts, and it shares mine.
Patricia smiled at the Frant.
I'm okay, she said.
You are lying, the Frant judged.
You're right.
Patricia reached up hesitantly and touched the Frant's arm. The skin was smooth and warm, but not resilient. She withdrew her fingers.
I'm not afraid of you, either of you, she said. Did you drug me?
No, Olmi answered, shaking his head vigorously. You must not be interfered with.
This is so strange. I don't even feel it's real, but I'm not afraid.
Perhaps that is well, the Frant said solicitously. Until such time as you awake, we are a dream.
After that exchange, they did not speak for hours. Patricia lay facing the window, noting that the corridor had changed its character yet again. Now it was covered with lines resembling densely clustered freeways. As they spiraled around the plasma tube, one turn every 15 or 20 minutes, she saw that the entire floor was covered with the designs, whatever they signified. There didn't seem to be anything moving, but across a distance of more than 20 kilometers, she couldn't be sure. The aircraft's spiral course was hypnotic. With a start, she realized she had been staring at new phenomena for several minutes without conscious awareness. The dense, packed patterns on the floor of the corridor now crawled with moving lights. Strung along the freeway lanes were lines of red and intense white beads. Lances of light swung up in arcs above the patterns and illuminated the edges of low-flying disks. Girdling walls at least 2 or 3 kilometers high broke the flow at regular intervals of about 10 kilometers. We are nearing Axis City, Olmi said.
What's all this? Patricia asked, pointing.
Metered traffic between domestic gates, Olmi said.
What are gates?
You called them wells when you discovered the first and second bands. They lead to spaces beyond the way, the corridor.
Patricia frowned. People go between the wells, enter and leave the corridor?
Yes, Olmi said. The Axis City regulates the flow along 1 billion kilometers.
But the wells, the gates, they can't possibly open into our universe, not in present time.
They don't, Olmi said. Now please, hold your questions until after we arrive. Too much information could reduce your purity.
Excuse me, Patricia said with false contrition.
However, you must not miss this, Olmi said. Please look straight ahead, at the wall over your couch. She stared at the smooth white surface. Olmi made a few quick clicking noises, and the surface rippled like a disturbed pool. The ripples spread wide into a broad rectangle and solidified. The rectangle became black, then filled with colorful snow. The snow attracted her eyes, and the rectangular frame blurred, passing from her notice. She might have been flying through the corridor alone. All around, the glowing, pulsing lights traveled their complex paths along the floor. Ahead, a dark circle was strung on the singularity, stretching from one side of the plasma tube to the other. Interrupted by the circle, the plasma tube changed color from white to a vivid oceanic blue. The Axis City lies beyond that barrier, Olmi said nearby. We'll be given clearance soon and pass through. She turned her head and the illusion dissipated.
No, no, please, Olmi said. Keep watching.
His tone and expression were almost little boy eager, proud. She faced the rectangle of snow again. The barrier filled her view. It was a somber dark gray-brown, shot through with radiating pulses of red. Where the singularity intersected it, the barrier glowed like molten lava. Voices began speaking words she couldn't understand, and Olmi responded in kind. We've been acknowledged, he explained to her. Keep watching. Directly ahead, a section of the barrier bubbled toward them and dissolved in a scatter of red pulses. They passed through. Her first impression was that they were suddenly underwater. The plasma tube had ballooned out in all directions, widening by several kilometers and glowing the oceanic blue she had seen around the circular barrier. The floor of the corridor was still visible on all sides, but reduced in definition and overlaid by the plasma's new color. Directly ahead, two broad cubes were strung in succession along the pale thread of the singularity.
Each of the visible faces of the cubes were marked with a broad horizontal cleft. The front of the foremost cube welcomed the singularity through a large hemispheric dimple, marked by glimmering spokes. At the center of the indentation was a red hole, and there the singularity was engulfed. Beyond the cubes, and several times as broad, was a cylinder rotating around its central axis, the line of the singularity. Its outer surface sparkled with thousands of lights. The side facing her was dark, but for a series of 5 radiating arrays of beacons. Next in line after the cylinder, 3 curved vanes stretched outward to the structure's maximum radius, perhaps 10 kilometers. The vanes seemed to touch or support the plasma tube, making it glow blue-white around the outermost edge of each vein. Whatever else was beyond the cylinder was effectively blocked from view. "Home," Olmi said behind her. She turned and looked at him, blinking. "The first segments are navigation and power stations, all automatic. The rotating cylinder is Axis Nadir. We can't see them from this perspective, but beyond lie Central City, Axis Thoreau, and Axis Euclid."
"Where are we going?" she asked.
"We'll enter a dock in Axis Nadir."
"How large is the city?"
"Do you mean how extensive or how many people?"
"Both, I suppose."
"It stretches 40 kilometers down the way, and it has a population of about 90 million, 20 million corporeal, embodied, 70 million stored in city memory."
"Oh."
She turned back to the screen and watched in silence as the craft moved inward, past the doubled cubes and along the dark side of the rotating cylinder. "I suppose in your time you would have called Axis City a necropolis, a city of the dead," Olmi continued. "But the distinction isn't quite so precise for us. I, for example, have died twice performing my duty to the Nexus."
"They revived you?" Patricia asked.
"They made me over again," he replied. She did not turn away from the screen, even though her back prickled. End of Side 6.